This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. During his years with the NBA, my guest Charles Barkley was a great power forward with a knack for saying whatever was on his mind. He played for the Philadelphia 76ers, the Phoenix Suns, and the Houston Rockets before retiring in December of 1999 after rupturing a tendon in his left knee. He was the NBA's most valuable player for the 1992-93 season, his first season with the Phoenix Suns. He was selected to 11 All-Star teams. Now Barkley is a studio analyst for TNT's Inside the NBA. Barkley has a new book called I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. His co-author Michael Wilbin says about Barkley, he's not for the easily offended, those stuck in neutral, or those without a generous sense of humor. You've never backed away from saying what's on your mind, and you've never really worried about toning it down or couching it in diplomatic language. And your book is filled with interesting opinions. One of the interesting opinions you give is that you don't like that expression "keeping it real," particularly when it's used by someone like Allen Iverson. what's the problem you have with that?
Well, because I'm not sure what it means, because I consider it a negative stereotype, because it's what it's really saying to a black person when it's used is, no matter how educated, how successful you are, you can act a certain way. You're keeping it real. And not really, you aren't keeping it real, because you should grow, you should mature. You hopefully go to college, get an education, get married, have kids. Stuff you do when you're young. Like, we all grew up poor. I like Allen Iverson, but Allen Iverson is not poor anymore. He doesn't live in the ghetto. So for his critics, for his fans to say if he does something wrong, he's keeping it real, he should take that as an insult, because he's a husband and a father and a terrific basketball player more than anything. But to say, to tell black athletes, they only said about black athletes, if they get in trouble, they said, well, they're defiant, they're keeping it real, I take that as a great insult.
Let me quote something you say in your book, I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. You write, it's weird being rich and black because you're caught between two worlds. Being rich puts you in a predominantly white world, but you don't just stop liking things about the life you've lived, your old friends, your old boys. You've outgrown most of them, but you want to maintain relationships. Can you talk about what that was like for you when you first became famous and wealthy and you didn't want to cut yourself off from your past, but at the same time, you wanted to grow and you wanted to change your life? I mean, heck, your life was changing whether you wanted it to change or not.
You know, it's a really unbelievable, I can't even think of the word I want to use when you're going through it. Like, you know, I was going to college, then you go to the NBA and you see this big, beautiful world, and then you go back home, you go back to the projects, and your friends want to, you know, I started playing basketball because I started doing some bad stuff. So you can't steal anymore, you can't do drugs anymore, can't stay out all night. You know, you got to train, and, you know, you just have to grow and mature. And you're caught between a rock and a hard place. And I think the problem a lot of athletes have, and one of the reasons that I want to talk about it in the book, you're caught in between. And you try to buy your friends. And before you know it, I knew it. You know, I had lent my friends like $1 million trying to, like, be their friends.
These are old friends you're
talking
about?
These are old friends. Like, I couldn't be with them, so I tried to buy their friendship to a certain degree. By like, well, I can't be with them because I live in Philly now. I don't live in Alabama anymore, but I want to keep my friends. So I'll just keep giving them money when I see them or sending them money, and they'll still be my friends. Because what happened, you finally say, you know what, I'm not sending you any more money. They stop being your friend. And except for a couple of those guys, they've all gone. And so is my money. So it's really... I don't know if that happens in the white community. I wrote this book from a black perspective, but there's a lot of BS that goes on in the black community. And one of the things I want to really talk about in the book was, we as black people, we are never going to be successful until we address our own problems, which are, number one, black-on-black crime, teenage pregnancies, and single-parent homes. It's too easy to say, well, white people treat us bad, or the system is flawed, we have to start treating each other better. And that's the biggest problem. We don't treat each other well.
One of the issues, I think, for a lot of athletes and actors and music stars is that if they get famous when they're young, they get a lot of money at a time when they're not emotionally mature yet.
Mm-hmm.
They still have the tastes of a teenager, but they have the money of somebody who's succeeded over a long period of time, even though they got that money really fast. And so sometimes I think people aren't sure how best to use that money because it came so quick.
Well, it's funny. It's funny because I wrote a thing in there about how Dr. J and Moses Malone influenced my life as far as. And I guess, I wrote this book from a black perspective. A lot of black people, when they become rich and famous, they buy a lot of gaudy things. And I did that. I bought like 6 cars. And Moses Malone and Dr. J, who really helped me, sit me down and said, think about this. If you put that money in a bank in 10, 15 years, you'll be able to buy 20 of those cars. He says, you don't need all 6 of those cars. This is Dr. J who really helped influence me. He says, young fella, everybody know who you are. You don't have to buy $100,000 cars, $200,000, $300,000 cars like a lot of these young kids do today. You need to put that money in the bank and let it grow. But a lot of guys, all these young kids, when they get their money now, they buy 10 cars, and they buy as much jewelry and all the crap they can buy. And that doesn't make them. The person you become is what you are.
A lot of players travel with an entourage, just in the same way a lot of music stars and actors travel with an entourage.
First of all, it's stupid when any of them do it.
That's what I'm wondering. Did you have an entourage? Or
The entourage is something that I don't know where it came from, to be honest with you. Never traveled. And as great as Dr. J was, he never traveled with the entourage or Moses. It's Magic Johnson, Larry Bird. I'm not sure what an entourage thing came from. And it's not good and never has been good, never will be good.
Well, why not? What's not good about it?
No other person. You don't bring your girlfriends to work, do you? And basketball, that's their job. I mean, no other person who goes to work take 5 or 6 of their friends. That's just common sense. Why should, I could see if you are an actress when you got a hair person, you got a personal assistant, maybe one person, but a person who travels with 5 or 6 people, 5 or 6 guys, that's just stupid.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Charles Barkley. He has a new book. It's called I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. You've always said that you didn't want to be a role model, per se. And, in fact, you even made a Nike commercial about that. Describe the commercial.
Well, I made a commercial, and what the commercial said, I am not a role model. Just because I can play basketball doesn't mean I should raise your kid. Parents are role models. Probably the thing I'm probably most proud of out of all the things I've ever done.
So whether you want to be a role model or not, you're kind of, at the very least, an inadvertent role model. So what kind of role model do you think you've been?
I've been just a man. And I said that I've done some good things. I made some mistakes. But I always keep going. I don't think anything can stop me as far as what I want to do and what I want to accomplish.
Probably in the mistake category come a couple of the more celebrated things from, celebrated, more infamous maybe is the word, things from earlier in your career, like a brawl you got into outside mm-hmm. of a bar.
I got arrested about 5 times for brawling, but I never worried about those because I was always acquitted. But if somebody threatened me, I don't care if you're famous or not, you have the right to protect yourself. The rest of things really didn't bother me, to be honest with you. Somebody threatened me, and I'm going to defend myself. I didn't worry about going to jail. I didn't worry about public perception. I would hope somebody who's a fan of mine or somebody who works for my team would not want me to, just because I'm in the limelight, get beat up.
So what kind of threats did you face?
just guys tell you they're going to kick you behind.
To show how tough they are.
Yeah, these always were guys were drunk. And like I said, I was always acquitted. It's always when you get arrested, it's in big letters. When you get acquitted, it's in small letters.
So give me a sense of how somebody would come up to you and challenge you.
Well, it's, you know what's interesting about that? Every single night you go out, there's one jerk. Or there's somebody who stands beside you and tells how much they don't like you. Or they're talking to another person, telling somebody how much they like you. You move to the other side of the bar. They'll follow you. I mean, every single night you go out, there's somebody who's trying to start some trouble with you. But the times I got arrested, guys came up and said they were going to fight me. And I'm like, I hit them and we hit each other and never lasted long. I never hurt anybody. They never hurt me. And it was just negative press.
So did you feel like you had to hit them before things got out of control?
I think you have to hit them before they hit you.
Uh-huh.
I mean, that's just normal. You can't let anybody hit you, no matter how small they are or how big they are. If you feel threatened, you got to hit them.
Let's talk a little bit about pain. You were kind of famous for being able to tolerate a pretty high threshold of pain. And you write in your book that, you know, ever since your early years, you played with a lot of pain. Did you have like a mental way of refocusing your attention away from the pain?
No, you know what it is, to be honest with you, you just want to play.
Uh-huh.
You know, because you know you have a great responsibility there. I always felt like, man, these people paid a lot of money to see me play. I'm going to shoot me up and throw me back out there. I mean, I took a lot of injections.
Cortisone?
Yeah. I mean, I've taken a ton, a lot of anti-inflammatories. I've taken a ton. But I always felt like, man, these kids are here, and all these people paid this money to see me play. I mean, because realistically, they come to see stars play. They might come to see their team play, but they want the stars to do well. So you always feel like that pressure, number one. But also, you know, there's nothing to me like playing basketball. It's the greatest job, the most fun in the world.
Now, when you're performing, adrenaline masks a lot of the pain, and the focus that you need to play masks a lot of the pain. How about when the game's over?
Well, you pay for it. You pay for it when the game is over and when your career is over. Like, I'm 39, but when I get up in the morning, and I notice this my last 4 or 5 years, you feel like you're 65 when you get out of bed in the morning. I mean, it is so, you're in pain. I know I got arthritis, you know, I got 2 bad knees, got arthritis in my fingers, back hurt all the time. I mean, it is like you pay for it when it's over.
Do you feel like you made the right choices and that your doctors and coaches made the right choices in deciding after an injury when it was time to go back into the game?
Well, you have to have trust in you got to trust yourself first and your doctor second. Because what happens is their job is to get you back out there. And I played on 3 teams, and we've had some good doctors and some bad doctors. I mean, I've been on teams where they fired doctors because they wouldn't let the players play too soon. I mean, I played with a trainer who got fired because he wouldn't rush players back.
Did you ever get into a fight with a doctor or a coach because you felt you weren't ready yet?
Oh, yeah. I had a couple confrontations. Oh, yeah. You know, because teams want you to play. I mean, you're their money line. I mean, they want you to play.
My guest is Charles Barkley. His new book is called I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is former NBA star Charles Barkley. He has a new book called I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. Now, when you joined the Philadelphia 76ers, it was toward the very end of Julius Erving's career.
Yes.
And I want to read something that was written in Sports Illustrated in 1988. It said, after a decade under the leadership of noted NBA diplomat Julius Erving, the Philadelphia 76ers now march to the unpredictable drumbeat of Charles Barkley, who doesn't have a tactful bone in his wide body. So I'm wondering, how would you compare yourself as like a team star with Julius Erving?
Well, it really bothers me when somebody calls me controversial or opinionated or tactless, because first of all, I don't think I'm ever going to say anything else that nobody thought or said before. But if you got a strong personality and other people are insecure, they're going to make it sound like you're a bad person. And I think that's a little bit unfair, because I just try to be honest. I would prefer people using, well, Charles is honest. If they say brutally honest, that's fine with me. But just to call somebody saying they don't have tact or they're controversial and opinionated because they don't say what you want them to say, I think that's biased.
So how do you think your style compared as a team leader with Julius Erving's, because he was considered to be...
Oh, I think he was, first of all, he was a great influence on me. But I'm not like him. I'm more emotional.
Mm-hmm.
And I needed emotion to play a certain way.
And what do you mean by that?
My emotion drove me to do well. You know, Dr. J was more talented than pretty much everybody. No, I needed my emotion and passion to help me take my game to another level. And I needed it. That's all I can say.
Do you think that there were generational differences between you and Julius Erving?
Well, I think there's generational gaps, yeah, between him and me and between these young guys today.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there's always generational gaps. But you know what? When push comes to shove, it still always gets back to who plays the best basketball. And I think that it's all right to be different. I don't like some of the stuff these young guys do, but I don't think it's bad, all of it. Some of it I think is bad, but not all of it.
What are some of the basketball differences, generational differences, that you like or don't?
I don't think they play good basketball. You know, a lot of the young guys think we don't like the way they play because they make a lot of money. We want them to be successful. We want them to make the game great. We have a problem with the way they play. I don't know if you watched the World Championship this year when we lost for the first time ever using NBA players. And we lost because they did not play good basketball. That's the problem we have with them. They do not play good basketball.
What do you think is the problem?
Well, they're lacking fundamentals. I think, number one, they're younger, and they haven't had a chance for their game to grow and mature. But also, I don't think coaches have the discipline to get on them. I mean, coaches are afraid of players nowadays. High schools, colleges, and an NBA.
In what way do you think coaches are afraid of players, and why do you think they're afraid?
Well, because I think the players make so much money now that it's a lot easier to fire coaches than it is players. I mean, the money is astronomical, and God bless them, but it obviously makes it really harder for you. If it comes down between players and coaches, which it always does at some point, the coach is gone.
Do you think there's a respect thing coming into play now in a way that it didn't before? For instance, when Allen Iverson's coach criticizes him, Iverson can say, he disrespected me.
Well, I think it's, you know, see, that's the thing. None of these guys, I shouldn't say none, but I'm being a little bit facetious. None of these guys could have played in the old days. You know, every time, and that was one of the things, anytime you see a coach criticize a player now, the player feels like he's disrespected. In the old days, coaches yelled and cursed you all the time, and it was like done to make you play better. And all these new guys, they take it as disrespect. They couldn't have played in the 60s, 70s, and 80s because coaches, it was like yelling and screaming was part of the whole thing.
Charles Barkley, his new book is called I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. He'll be back in the second half of the show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with former NBA star Charles Barkley. He was the NBA's most valuable player in 1993. He played for the Philadelphia 76ers, the Phoenix Suns, and the Houston Rockets before retiring in 1999. Throughout his career, he was famous for his outspokenness and controversial opinions. He offers some of his opinions in his new book, I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. You grew up in Leeds, Alabama. Where is that? What kind of place was it to grow up?
Leeds is just a typical southern small town with one stoplight, and everybody knows everybody. No McDonald's. You know, I always say if...
Still? Still no McDonald's?
We got a McDonald's now. We do now. But it's weird. I always say, you can always tell how small your hometown is if you got a Dairy Queen instead of a McDonald's. Or your steakhouse is a Sizzler. You can always, if you live in a small town, you're going to have those two things, a Dairy Queen. You're not good enough for a Ruth Chris or a Morton's or a McDonald's, so you're going to have a Dairy Queen, and that's it, and a Sizzler.
Anything you liked about growing up in a small town?
I did like it because I didn't have to deal with all the distractions a lot of these kids in big cities have to deal with. I think there is a big difference growing up in a small town than big city. And I really enjoyed growing up there.
Your father left your family when you were a baby, I think. So you were raised by your mother and your grandmother. You say your grandmother was the disciplinarian in the family. What was her approach to disciplining you?
If you didn't do right, she beat you down. I mean, it was very simple. She ran a tight ship because my mother was a maid and my grandmother worked at a meat packing factory. And that was my grandmother was like the father figure. She was really strong. She was really disciplined. And I love my grandmother to death. She's probably the most influential person in my life. And it's just been a great deal for me how she took care of me.
You say she'd beat you with what?
Switches. Those tree limbs would be the best way to explain it. But they were good. It taught me a lot. I think kids should get disciplined.
Well, most people now think that that's like child abuse.
Well, and that's why the kids are crazy now. See, I think kids were better back in that day. You know, we can't discipline kids anymore because every time you do anything to them, it's considered child abuse. But if you look at it realistically, kids were much better behaved back then than they are now.
Did you beat your kids with switches?
I have a daughter who, she gets spanked, but she's a good girl. She's a great girl. But if I had to, I would.
But you didn't?
I have not.
Okay. You say your family sold bootlegged alcohol mm-hmm. to supplement the income. Did you ever taste it?
Oh, yeah, many times.
How was it?
Nasty. That's nasty. You know, that's one of the things why I have to give great admiration and respect to my mother and grandmother because, you know, they were just trying to make ends meet. And every weekend we had a card game going on. But that's actually like, that's your responsibility when you're a parent. Your job is to find a way to take care of your kids. And it made me appreciate them more because they were willing to, they were scrubbing floors and my grandmother in the meat factory, and that wasn't enough. They were like doing anything to make ends meet, and that made me appreciate and respect them even more.
How did you start playing basketball?
I started playing basketball when I was 9. I started playing because I started getting in trouble. You know, I'd start stealing, staying out late, and things like that.
What were you stealing?
You know, it's a kind of weird CDs, like music. And you know, the thing was stupid. We would steal stuff that we didn't even need, like pens, pencils.
Because they were easy to steal?
Because we were just bored. I mean, just because we were bored. And that was not what I wanted to do. And then one night, the police was chasing us. And I made a mind of mine that night. I said, I'm going to go play basketball. I got to do something to stay out of trouble. Got to. Because that's not the life I want to lead.
So did you realize right away that you were good?
No, I wasn't any good in the beginning. I wasn't actually, at the time I'm 9, I wasn't any good until I became a senior in high school. That's the thing that's unique and ironic. I wasn't any good in high school.
Did you have a particularly good coach when you were a senior?
we had a really good team and a good coach, but I grew from 5'10 to 6'5 in 1 year.
Wow, that's a lot in 1 year.
Yeah, and that made a big difference, obviously, in my talent.
Did you see yourself going from being really tall to being comparatively short in the NBA?
I did. Well, you noticed that first in college. Because in college, you know, there's a lot of big guys in college, a lot of guys who are tall. And you go from like being the big man on campus height-wise to like the shortest guy on the team. So, yeah, it is somewhat mind-boggling, but you just have to work harder.
Okay, in college, you had the reputation, you were considered heavy compared to the other players, right? And you had nicknames.
Is heavy and fat the same thing?
I don't know.
Yeah, I was a big boy in college.
I thought fat would maybe sound too too heavy, but...
Got to have tact.
Yeah, I was just trying to figure out which sounded more tactful,
yeah,
heavy or
yeah.
fat.
You know, I was fat in college.
What did fat mean? I mean,
I weighed 300 pounds.
But you were 6'4", so...
Yeah, but I was 300 pounds. I was like a little roly-poly.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, I loved the play.
Must have been hard to jump if you were heavy.
No, it was easy to jump. I always had the talent.
Uh-huh.
Well, I don't know if I always had it, but I had it at that time. But I just loved the play, and jumping was easy.
So did it get to you when people ribbed you and called you nicknames?
No, it motivated me.
What were some of the names?
Bread Truck, Fat Boy, Blimpy. I use all that stuff as motivating, you know, because you want to show people you can do it. And there's nothing better than succeeding. That's the thing I try to stress to kids. There's nothing better than succeeding.
Now, apparently some fans would send you pizzas delivered to the bench when you were in college.
Oh, yeah. They had a lot of fun with that when I'd play on the road. There'd always be, not always, but probably five or six times when I was in college, they ordered a pizza for me and just kept calling my name. It was fun. I had a good time with it. I was never bitter or resentful about my nickname because it got me a lot of publicity, number one. But also, I'm able to laugh at myself anyway.
Did you ever eat the pizzas?
No.
In case they were spiked?
Too close to game time.
No, I was thinking you could save them for after the game. But then,
no.
Of course, they'd be cold.
Yeah.
You play a lot of golf.
Mm-hmm.
Did you always like golf? Did you ever look down on golf?
You know, the golf is one of the probably most amazing sports in the world because once you start playing, you're addicted to it.
Mm-hmm.
But I thought it was the most stupid sport in the world when I saw it on television when I was little. But then I was like, one of my teammates, Andrew Toney, told me to try it one day. And then it becomes like a battle of trying to do better at it. I mean, that was the thing. You know, you're trying to do better at it. And I love it. I try to play every single day, and I love it.
Now, one of the things people make fun of with golf is the kind of suburban golf fashions of the pastel pants and the white belt and the pastel shirt and the white golf shoes. So I'm sure you don't wear that when you're golfing.
You know, I thank God for Tiger Woods, number one, because he's a great golfer, but he's definitely made improvements in the fashion. I mean, he's definitely made improvements in the fashion. He single-handedly changed the entire golfing dressing fraternity. But that's the thing I think Tiger should be recognized for more than just playing golf.
What else do you do to keep in shape?
I work out a lot. I mean, I do. I mean, because you know why? Because I look at my weight problems like the Taliban. You can't kill it. You can't kill it. You know, it's like a constant struggle as you get older to stay skinny. And it's like the Taliban. It just won't die.
Now, does working out help with the arthritis and with the other aches and pains that you have from your career in basketball? Or does working out aggravate that?
Well, it probably aggravates it. But it won't aggravate as much as me being fat. You know, I mean, you got to try to reach a happy compromise. I mean, you got to reach a happy compromise. I mean, because, like, I can't be fat. I mean, I joke around with my friends. I'm too good looking to be fat. I mean, I don't want to be fat.
How much do you play basketball now? I know now you have an injury, so at the moment you're not playing at all.
I don't play, you know, I might have played once or twice a year, just screwing around.
Mm-hmm.
But I miss it.
Charles Barkley, thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, you're welcome, and it was terrific. I enjoyed the interview because I enjoy speaking for myself. I'm intelligent enough to speak for myself. I get tired of doing interviews where a guy talked to me for 5 minutes and then put 3 seconds on television. You're like, you can make anybody sound like an idiot in that scenario. And that's why I'm excited to get, because with my new show, and the book gives me a chance to speak for myself, but also with the new show I have coming, I'm going to give other newsmakers an opportunity to speak for themselves. And that's what, you know, because these people are a lot smarter than people realize. And thank you.
Thank you. Charles Barkley's new book is called I May Be Wrong, But I Doubt It. This is Fresh Air.